Hi, it's Martha Stewart. You know, I spend a lot of time thinking about dirt. At 3 a.m., at all hours of the day, really. What people don't know is that not all dirt is the same. You need dirt with the right kind of nutrients. New Miracle-Gro organic raised bed and garden soil is so dense, so full of nutrient-rich, high-quality ingredients. Miracle-Gro is simply the best.
Now's the time to save 30% on wedding jewelry, only on BlueNile.com. Make sure your wedding ring is the one with your pick of diamond and lab-grown diamond bands, all hand-finished and graded for excellence. Or surprise her with something blue she'll love for life, like a stunning pair of sapphire earrings. Blue Nile's jewelry experts are available 24/7 to help, from fit questions to style advice. Right now, get up to 30% off at BlueNile.com. BlueNile.com.
You know, making movies is hard. Welcome. This is the podcast about the struggle of being an independent filmmaker. I'm Mark Bissell, the founding host of the podcast, and I'm a sci-fi horror filmmaker. And my first feature film, The Alternate, is out now on digital, DVD, Tubi, Amazon Prime, all the places. And my second script, feature length as well, is done and in the works.
Yay. I'm Liz Manischel. I'm a writer, director, producer who has directed two features, Bread and Butter and Speed of Life. I'm currently making my third, Best Friends Forever. I'm a producer's rep and I used to work at Sundance.
On this Thursday bonus episode, we're going to play the interview from episode 253 from March 2020 with writer, director Tom Huang, who talks about making his feature film Find Me and his filmmaking philosophy, which I thought was a good match for Clinton because we get into a little bit of his philosophy of filmmaking as well. And, you know, they both talk about making their features. After that, we play another round of Y'all the Expert. But first, don't forget to check out our Patreon page, www.patreon.com/MMIHpodcast. This is the way that the show will continue to thrive and strive and grow and live. Yeah, I mean, just on a side note, like we've gotten a couple new people joining the Patreon in the last couple weeks, which feels great because I felt like it was crickets for a really long time. Thanks, everyone, for supporting us. And for those who have been a part of the Patreon forever and just continue to support us, you guys are amazing. Also, make sure to give us a review and a rating on Apple, or review or a rating on Apple Podcasts, either one. Those are amazing. But without any further bibble babble, here's our throwback interview with Tom Huang.
This week, we're really excited to welcome filmmaker, actor, probably many, many things, Tom Huang. Am I seeing your name right? Because I just went for it.
That's right. Tom Huang. It rhymes with Bong. That's how people mostly remember it.
I do something similar with my name. I totally get that.
What's your rhyme?
Oh, it's man. It's a shell. Man, a shell.
Nice.
I will now forever remember that. Thank you.
Yeah, okay, good.
That's funny.
Ulrich, do you have anything?
I do. People get my name wrong all the time. And I say it's like all Rick, like all the Ricks. You know? Okay. So they're always like Alric or Alric or, you know, Alrique.
So I just imagine a room of Rick Ashley's, and then that's how I get it, all Ricks.
Okay. Oh, there you
all
go.
The Ricks. Yeah,
perfect.
All the Ricks. They're all there. All right.
Well, so Tom, you were about to say something, all Rick.
No, you go ahead, Liz, man in a shell.
So, Tom, I met you at a film independent event, and you were pitching to us about this film. And I remember just think whenever I go to these events, like all the filmmakers who are pitching are very, very fancy. And I felt you were very, very fancy. That was my first thing I wanted to say. But my second thing is that was my segue into, can you tell me how you got to that event? Can you tell us a little bit about yourself, your 1 minute bio?
Sure. I am a indie filmmaker and sometimes TV writer. This is my third independent feature, and along the way, I've kind of paid the bills by being writing for TV network sitcoms and producing, directing, writing stuff for various studios and independent things and things like that. And so, like, yeah, I think I'm still waiting for, like, to be able to do this for a living full time. But with this film, it's gotten a little bit closer, which is great. And then with the film independent thing, one of my scripts was selected for the Film Independent Screenwriters Lab a few years ago. So I became a film independent fellow, and they had just put a call out saying, "Hey, do you have a film that you need help marketing on? We have this panel going on." And I said, yeah, sure. And then they emailed me back and said, yeah, sure. And I was really excited. And it was just at the right moment because we had just figured out that we're going to do this kind of creative distribution with Indie Rights, and we're going to do our own marketing, and to like be able to pitch to a bunch of people like yourself, Liz, and people from Amazon and Alamo Drafthouse and things like that. It was just the right moment, just serendipity.
Oh, I have like a trillion questions after that intro. The first one I want to ask is like, what happened after that pitch? What were you pitching for? Like, was it for production funds or for post funds?
No, it was a panel. It was a marketing panel, actually. And it was all talking about like creative ways to market your independent film. And the great thing about the panel was that it was kind of set up to be like, it was for films so like, hey, what if your film didn't get into Sundance or South by Southwest, and you still have this great film that got into these mid-level festivals, you know, that distributors didn't like flock to because they don't go to those festivals. You know, what are you supposed to do now that, you know, we've kind of figured out that like distributors, for the most part, you know, unless it's a big film that was at Sundance or something, you know, they'll give you a deal, but they won't necessarily know how to market your film or like put any time into marketing it. And really, you know, I think we're coming to find that like marketing is probably the most important thing now for indie filmmakers, as opposed to finding a distributor, because we could like put up our film in various sites or put it up for people to see anywhere we want by ourselves now. And so this marketing forum, which just had a bunch of people who are involved in marketing for films and TV, and they said, hey, pitch your film, and you know, they'll give you some ideas and, you know, ways you could market it. And so that's how it came about.
And this is, just to clear everything up at the beginning of the podcast, this is for the film Find Me. I don't even know if we've said that, so I want to make sure we say that. But I remember you got up on stage, Tom, and like, by the way, I didn't do any prep, so I was very confused about what I was supposed to do in terms of giving people feedback. Wow, there's like a trend in this conversation already. Yes. Liz doesn't do prep. And I remember you stood and you talked about your film, and you were so calm and confident and charming. Like, it was like a really a unique presence. And then I go and I start watching your film, and I see this character whose life has been sucked out of him in this film.
Yeah.
And I just, now I know Alreca has 20 questions. I have, you know, at least 19. And I just don't, I want to know everything about like whether you're an actor, whether you're not an actor, how you made this film. Okay. But I feel like Alric has the first question. Please make sure to touch on those things.
Well, yeah, go ahead, Tom.
Let me just like, yeah, so for the audience that are listening, let me just say, Find Me is a film about an emotionally wounded accountant who kind of breaks out of his shell to like search for a coworker friend who has left clues for him in national parks across the West. So he goes off and he goes to like parks like Death Valley and Yosemite and Zion National Park to try to find her. So that's just the basic log line for the film. And then, yeah, so I'll just say that so that everyone kind of knows what the film's about.
Nice. And then I was just like, to follow what Liz was saying, are you an actor in training? Like, what is your, like, were you an actor first and then a director first and then an actor? Like, how did this come about?
Yeah, let's wind way back. When I was at UCLA as an undergraduate, I thought I wanted to be an actor. And so I started looking for places to act at UCLA, which is, by the way, 70% Asian. And I found that there were no parts for me as an Asian American, even at the theater department. Yeah. I mean, at the time when I was there, I think it definitely got better after I left. But yeah. And so I just realized like, if I wanted to get involved in this, I'm going to have to like make roles for myself that are interesting for Asian Americans. And that's when I really got into, decided I was going to write and direct. And so I became a creative writing major. But at the same time, I've always loved acting and think it's great. I've always done improv and that kind of thing. But like, I realized that I couldn't put all my time and energy in doing one craft at the same time with writing, directing, and acting. And so, you know, I've always kind of acted on the side, but like put all my energy into writing, directing. So since I went to film school at Loyola Marymount University afterwards. And then at film school, I acted in all my films just because I could, and just so I could like keep that vein going. For this particular film, I kind of didn't want to act in it, but when we figured out that we'd have to make this all ourselves with our own money, it just made more sense. Being that the character could fit me pretty well, as I wrote a character that was like close to someone of my own personality. So,
but it's not your personality. That is what I'm saying. It is like, it seems like, I mean, you would know best. You know more than I do who you are. But like, this person seemed 180 degrees from you.
He is a version of me, though. So it is like a reserve version of me. Like when I'm around people, like, I don't know. I'm uncomfortable with, then there's a certain person I am. And if I'm, you know, around like Liz, of course, I'm very animated and happy and loud. And so, yeah, there's, you know, there's different sides of me. So I would say that he's a side of me. And also, you know, it actually is based on a person, a friend of mine, who I was close to, who went through a very painful divorce. And the way it changed him in ways that I never thought it could change someone really disturbed me. And also really, you know, it stuck with me. And so, like, I kind of followed my friend, who I was very close to, too, and the way he was and why he, you know, why it came about for him as far as his pain. So it was like a mix of both. It was like someone close to me and also myself, a part of me in there. So,
well, it's just a testament to your acting ability, because, you know, Liz, obviously, and myself as well, just really believe the character that you portrayed.
Great. That's great.
And, you know, it was also a very endearing performance, which I think doesn't always happen in indie film, where you like really find a strong connection with the lead actor. Yeah. And, you know, I felt that all the way through. And then I didn't even realize that it was you until I saw the credits, and I was like, oh shit, he starred in it and directed it. Fuck, this guy's awesome.
Well, I mean, I also like, I mean, however you know, it's, but like a lot of the heavy emotional lifting is done by my amazing actors that are around me.
Oh yeah, totally.
So that was on purpose. Like, I did not, when I wrote my character, I did not want to be in the position where, you know, I had to like do 5 takes of sobbing and crying. Some of my actors did just on cue, which is amazing.
Yeah. How did you find Amelia? I've only seen like a little bit, but I love her.
Yeah, yeah. It's so, first of all, we knew from the start that we would want to make this a SAG film, because I wanted, you know, real working actors. And from my experience, I know that there are plenty of amazing actors out there who haven't like quite have a huge name yet, but are just, you know, really talented. And that's just the benefit of being in Los Angeles, I think, you know, casting in Los Angeles. So we did a SAG low budget indie deal, which allowed us to hire, you know, SAG actors for $150 a day, plus paying for health insurance and all that kind of stuff. But it made it affordable. And so we just cast, Amelia from auditions. I had a casting director who, a friend of mine from Film Independent, like said, oh, I have this casting director who wants to do diverse films. And I met with her and she loved the script and really, we really got along. And said, so she helped me cast the film, and she helped find like Sarah and Kirby Howell Baptiste, who is the African-American, she's actually African-English actress. Death Valley, and she's also in Barry and Killing Eve, and
I recognized her. Yeah. I was like, well, yeah, that makes sense.
She's amazing. And like, you know, it's just, for any filmmakers out there, it's like, if you really work on and have a really great script, and I don't know if you guys found this also, like, you'll be really surprised at like the people who like will read it and, you know, who have a lot of credits, who'll come out and say, hey, I want to do this. And that was the case with Kirby in particular, because, you know, I saw her reel and I was just like, and she said, yeah, she want to do this. And I called her and I said, hey, you know, we're already paying you, you know, SAG ultra low budget, right? I just want to make sure that we're clear. She's like, yeah, I want to do this. And I'm like, wow. And so, and then Sarah, in particular, the person who plays Amelia, she came in and read, and it was great. And then she came in for a follow-up read, and she read.
Don't give it away.
Yeah, I'm just saying, she has a big monologue, and she just nailed it. And I'm watching it going, when I started doing that, I'm like, that's who I want. And in particular, I wanted a diverse cast. So I was looking for a Latina actress. And so, you know, that helped my casting director kind of narrow down the kind of pool of actresses. But we saw a lot of really great actresses. But she just had that mix of being funny, being smart, and a little bit of that like kind of darkness in her that I wanted from Amelia. And also just a consummate professional actress, which is so amazing.
Nice.
Yeah.
I have a like kind of side question, but like, did you act in all your other features as well, in your other two?
I did, actually. I didn't have as a major part as I did in this one, but I always like wanted to act in it in my films, just because I enjoy it so much. But it actually has helped me, you know, learn how to act and direct in a film and find my style of doing that. And so over the experience of my films, I found that, like, you know, I really need to trust my DP, really talk with him or her beforehand and how I want it shot. And we talk the same language so that I can know that, like, if we're, you know, running gunning, that, like, you know, they know exactly what the shot, kind of shot I need to look like. And then for me as a director, like when I'm acting with another, in a scene, whenever I start feeling, when I feel that like the scene feels real, like I'm having a real conversation with this person a real conversation with me, like we are having right now, then I feel like, okay, that's a good take. And then let's just do a couple more and then move on from there. So that's kind of like the kind of systems that I developed. And I think a lot of it has come from, you know, experience from film school and doing other films that has helped.
So Ulrich is about to make his first feature.
Oh, wow. Congratulations.
Which is very exciting.
Yes.
I just finished my second feature, and you, yes, Tom, have just entered into the three feature dome. I don't know what you call this, like whatever the dome is.
The three feature club.
Yes. Yeah. You alluded to this a little bit in your bio, like about how you think things are are changing in a way for you, and that you feel like a little bit more that you're breaking into or breaking out. Can you talk a little bit about that, the changes between different features and how your career has grown?
Sure, sure. So my first feature, actually, I made in film school, and I was ready to make a feature, and I told my professor that I was making an hour long, I gave him an hour long script, and then he said, okay. And then I just ended up shooting like an hour and a half worth of stuff. And so I was really green. It ended up doing really well on the film festival circuit, which is great, but got a great write-up in LA Times. And then we just end up just distributing a DVD with some distributor that I just met, who is a nice guy, but not a huge distributor or anything. So that was fine. And then the second one we made, I actually got a sales agent that someone recommended. They found me a distributor. It was a new distributor from Canada. And they had like 15 other films. And so they distributed it. And then after the first quarter of not paying us, they took off for Canada with everybody's money. And so,
oh shit.
Wait, what's their name? What's the name of the distributor?
Jeez, what's the name of it?
I'll Google it right now for you if you want.
The guy's name, the guy who runs it, is Rui Da Silva. He's still in Canada. And he's also a record, I guess, a music producer as well.
Wow.
So
he just ripped everybody off.
Ripped basically everybody off and knew that no one could really afford to go to Canada and chase him down.
Wow.
And that film also, like, you know, got a lot of great festival awards. We got great write-up in all these publications. And you know, it was like, looked like it was going to be okay for me. But basically, it was just, you know, independent filmmakers, like, nightmare.
Wow.
Yeah.
And then for these first two features, can you just give us a rough idea of the budget level?
They were definitely under $100,000.
Okay.
Yeah, so.
And then same genre, like drama, indie drama, or different genres?
Yeah, I would say they're both dramedies. So
dramedies, drama, okay.
With some comedy elements into it. Like, you know, my great heroes are like James Brooks and
Tom, I knew this is why we are friends. I'm like, the tense is poor in my construction, but now I'm understanding this. James L. Brooks is my hero.
Oh, yes, absolutely. James L. Brooks.
Wait, say more directors.
Broadcast News is like, Alexander Payne.
Yeah.
Ong Lee's earlier films.
Cool, I'm in.
Wait, you don't like
just
the Hulk?
Just say Whit Stillman and we'll be done. Yeah. Say Nicole Hall of Center, say Alison Anders.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, okay. Absolutely.
Thank you.
And then, oh God, I forget the guy's name. The guy who did The Station Agent.
Oh my God, I love that.
Yeah.
Station Agent's a good one.
Yeah. I've been in fights with my parents over that movie. I love that movie.
You know,
okay,
I don't know what it's like for you guys, but like, it's like, you know, you get caught up when you're trying to think of the next movie you're going to make, you know, about, oh, I got to do this. And you see the ones that, you know, are hitting it big in Sundance or whatever. And then like you see a filmmaker like, you know, for me, Alexander Payne, or I watch Broadcast News again, and I'm just like, oh yeah, that's the kind of film I want to make. And it kind of like, you know, centers you. And so like that kind of always happens. So for me, for Find Me, I was like, you know, kind of writing it and kind of all over the place with it. And then I watched Columbus. Did you guys see that?
It's our fellowship film. It was first fiction fellowship
that's
film
right
at Sundance for
that's
my
right
department. Yeah.
And I'm like, oh yeah, like that's the kind of film I want to make. That's for Find Me. That's kind of centered me as far as just the look of it and the characters and the pace of it. It's like, so, you know, for me, it's like watching other films really helps me, you know, get centered of what I want to do with the films.
Now I'm curious about the third film. So you said the first two were under 100,000. So the third one, is it the same budget roughly? Or
yeah, it's the same budget roughly. It all came out of my pocket actually.
Oh damn, that answers my next question.
Yeah. I mean, thank goodness for some home equity. So this one, you know, I knew that after the debacle from the second one, that like I needed to take charge more of everything, and not, I couldn't trust people. And that's, you know, the sad truth. So my producer really loved the script. My DP really loved the script. And so the film came about because of a lot of filmmaker friends who said, hey, I like the script. Let's all do this together. You know, that's actually what made it fun too. But I think that, you know, I think there's a question that that I saw before, that like, you know, what helps you make the film? And it was actually just a network of filmmakers, people like you guys, people like you. I just met at film school, and people I met at film festivals, and other things that I've made, that we all got together. And that's the only reason I was able to make this film for the amount of money that I did. So we shot it, and I had a test screening at LMU with a bunch of my friends who I know were very happy to, you know, say bad things about my film and make me cry if they didn't like it. And so, which is important to me, you know, you want honest feedback. And so after the lights, just about 7 or 8 of them, the lights came on after the film, and I looked in the audience, and like a couple of them were like crying. And I was like, what the hell? And it's like, and at that time when I knew that like something was going on with this film that like worked, because, you know, I wrote, directed, acted, edited the film. So I'm so deep in this film. Like I'm just like going on instinct, and I don't know what it is anymore after a while. So this really helped me, realize I had something here. And that's the first time I've seen that from a rough cut of a film. And then we went to film festival circuit, went about 14 film festivals, and universally the reaction from people was the same. It's like, the lights come on, people are crying, and then people would just come up to me and say, you know, I came to see the national parks in the film, but then you got me hooked in the story. And these are across the country, from Oregon to Arkansas to Idaho to New York to Atlanta. And so, you know, it was like a bunch of test screens of people I didn't know. And that's when I knew, like, holy crap, you know, we have some sort of connection here. And that's when I knew that, like, I had an audience, a very specific audience, people who love natural parks and outdoors that I could target. When we're done with the festival thing, that's when I knew that we had to do all the marketing. And then we got a bunch of really terrible distribution offers from people, legitimate companies. People come up to me and say, Neo, you know, we'll give you 50% or whatever, 45%. And
what?
Then I would ask, yeah. And then I would ask them like about the marketing plan, and university, all of them would say like, we have people that can handle that. I'm like, well, can I talk to them? Well, yeah, I mean, you know, we got these guys that can make posters. And I'm just like, no, I need to know a plan. You know, I can't just leave this in your hands when I know that we have an audience for
right.
this.
It's your baby. Yeah,
exactly. And so when I just got a bunch of befuddled answers and also just bad deals, we found this distributor, Indie Rights, who got really good reviews from people. I talked to a lot of filmmakers with them, and they're very honest, and they only take 20%. They do all the work. There's no upfront fees. And I knew that they had done so much business that I could at least know that I would get my money. And I knew that I want to take the marketing on myself anyway. And so that really helped us. We went with them. We did all our marketing, which is a whole nother story that I go into. But basically, to tell you why this film has been so much stronger, it's like we got reviews and places like Outside Magazine, which is our you know, one of the most respected publications for the outdoor market, and then like places like the Hollywood Reporter and Chicago Reader and all these places really loved the film. We got some great reviews, and so I was like, oh great, okay, so we have some great reviews, we have a good start. And then we started doing Facebook ads as our main way to get the word out. After the first couple weeks of just doing rentals and downloads, my distributor came back to me and said, hey, you know what? Usually we only do a week of this, and then, you know, then we just send out to Amazon Prime. But you guys have done so well. Like, you've done better than like anybody that we've ever seen as far as just rentals and downloads on Amazon. I'm like, really? And so it's like,
wait,
yeah.
They only do a week of transactional?
Well, it depends on the film, but like,
okay.
they found with a lot of films that like people weren't just watching on transactional through Amazon, you know, cause they would just wait for Prime. And then once it got to Prime, it would just take off. So we spent 6 weeks on transactional. And then she said, okay, we're ready to do Amazon Prime. And then once it went to Amazon Prime, it just like took off. Like, in a crazy way, if you look at our graph, it just like went from like, you know, a certain amount of number into the millions of minutes of views like per week.
Oh wow!
And, yeah, and then also people on our Facebook ads, these are ads now. Okay, We put up an ad with a trailer, which, you know, we had worked very hard on research and targeting and all that kind of stuff. And we found a target that seemed to work. And then I don't know if you guys get this with your social media ads, but like people were like tagging people on their ads and responding in the ad like it was a real post. You know, like, you know, hey, Fred Smith, and, you know, and hey, hey, Molly, let's get together and watch this tonight. And there are like hundreds of responses like that going on this ad. And I'm like telling these people like, hey, you know, this is an ad, right? It's like,
yeah, it's so funny.
You know, I'm invading your privacy with this, you know, like, and but people like saw it as like some sort of post, and people were starting to relate to it. And then I started getting emails from people and posts from all sorts of people inspired the film. This is what's been happening lately. And the viewership has grown steadily. We opened in the first week of June. The viewership has grown steadily every week since then. And it's still growing. And I'm getting emails from people saying how much they're inspired by the film, how much they love the film. In particular, one guy was this cancer patient who was going through chemo, and he saw the film. I was watching chemo and was so inspired. He sent me pictures of national parks he went to after he saw the film.
Wow.
And
wow.
Like, you know, I almost like broke down in tears watching this. And so despite whatever happens money wise with the film, like seeing all these responses of people inspired by the film, this made me realize like, this is why I'm making movies. You know, it's like, I'm making movies because I want people to be inspired by film as much as I've been inspired by films like James L. Brooks.
Right.
And so to be able to actually feel that, in a very tangible way like this, has been amazing. And it's been such a step up from my other film. So, you know, long story short, like that is really what's changed from the other mother films that I realized, like, you know, I'm actually reaching people with this. It's been pretty amazing.
Well, Tom, you answered all the questions on the outline. Like, literally, I just went down and looked at all the questions, and they're gone. Ulrich, I'm sure you have things to say.
Yeah, so let's back it up. So you're talking about the distributors that you were approaching before you got to Indie Rights, and the things they were saying. Were these, like, reputable distributors, or were they, like, kind of the more unknown, smaller camp of distributors?
It was half and half. Like, some were reputable, and some were like newer, up-and-coming ones. I would say the reputable ones were the ones that are most, like, kind of dismissive of anything that I had suggested.
And nobody was offering you any kind of minimum guarantee of any kind or any money up front?
Yeah, absolutely not.
Okay.
Yeah, that was the other issue, too, is just, like, you know, it's like, if I'm going to put money into market, my own money into marketing, it's like, you got to help me out here, you know? And so with one distributor, we came very close to working on a deal, a marketing deal, where they would put in writing how much money they would put in marketing and social media ads and like specific things. So I knew that they were going in direction, and then they pulled out at the last minute.
Wow.
And then I was just like, okay, well, there you go.
And so, and why was Indie Rights the right choice? Was it because they took a smaller percentage and they sort of left it more into your hands as far as the marketing goes?
Yeah, it was a number of reasons. One, the main thing was that, you know, we vetted them. I talked to about 15 filmmakers who were with them, you know, that I saw were with them, and emailed them. And the great thing is with the indie film community is like people love to like write back. I found people write back to you and want to talk to you and like help you out. And so all these people wrote back to me and said like, yeah, you know, they pay on time, they're honest, they're very helpful. So that was one of the main reasons. The other reason was, yes, you know, they only took 20% and with no upfront. And also the third thing was like, you know, I knew that I'd be taking on this marketing myself. Any help I can get to deal with other crap, you know, I could put up this film on Amazon Prime myself and Tubi TV or whatever, you know, but then, you know, that's just more work. And, you know, already this is like an unsustainable, and I'm sure Liz, you can relate to this, a sustainable rate to like have a healthy life of just doing the marketing. And so, you know, taking 20%, I thought was, and I talked to my producer and other people involved, and they thought that was a good idea too. Just was more than an equitable amount to like, so that I cannot have to worry about, you know, the distribution platforms. We still did actually theatrical ourselves.
Oh, wow.
But they did all the digital stuff.
Okay, back up. So before we enter theatrical, what platforms did Indie Rights get the film on?
Their main platform is Amazon. So they get on Amazon Prime, Google Play, iTunes,
all the open transactional platforms.
Yeah, all the big ones, and then also Tubi TV, and then they also they have a booth at Cannes and AFM, and so they could also like handle, you know, any sort of international for you, which is also a plus for us.
Okay, so but they don't Hulu and Netflix; those are all off the table, right?
Yeah, those are all curated. So
okay, and they don't even submit to those.
If you really want to, they could take a stab at it, but I mean, I think Linda has said like
it's incredibly hard these days to get a one-off subscription VOD deal.
Yeah, and she found that the deals that they were getting from them was just not. Was not as good as just doing it themselves on Amazon Prime.
They're also really big. I know Linda, and they're also really big on AVOD over at Indie Rights.
Yes.
So they're going to talk about that Roku channel, which I'm sure they talked to you about.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And so were you on Roku also?
That hasn't happened yet. So all the AVOD, I mean, we got on Tubi, but like that stuff will come up like later on. So they do have a you know, a schedule.
And then how long were you on Amazon, you know, just for VOD, you know, for paying for the link? Was that like a week, you said, 2 weeks, a month?
We ended up going 6 weeks on VOD.
6 weeks.
Yeah.
And then how much, and do you know the numbers from those 6 weeks at this point?
Yeah, yeah. That's the other thing about Indie Rights is that they're very good about like, you know, telling us numbers.
So do you mind sharing that with us? Like what you got back in your 6 weeks?
I don't have the exact numbers with me right now, but you know, it was basically just with the AVOD, it probably ended up being about 25,000.
Nice. That's pretty good, man.
That's amazing. That's huge.
That's huge. Yeah.
And then of course, like with, I'm sorry. Not AVOD. I'm talking about rentals and downloads.
Right, rentals and downloads. Yeah, right.
TVOD. Yes,
exactly.
Yeah, yeah. TVOD. And then, you know, of course, it's much less for streaming. But the numbers we have been doing on streaming has still made it, you know, very giving us a healthy return so far.
So how many? And then six weeks on TVOD, and then on like just on Prime, it's been probably what like 2 months.
Let's see, on Prime, mid July to now. So, yeah.
And then what are those numbers, just so we can hear, too, if you mind sharing?
So we've been averaging the last few weeks, we've been averaging probably about like 125,000 hours a week viewed.
Wow.
So that ends up to be like 7.5 million minutes. That's what you've been getting. That's the kind of numbers we're getting in viewership. And then I think I'm not sure, depending on the customer engagement, they have some weird, like, you know, way of computing computing costs, but like it's basically, you know, some anywhere like less than 10 cents an hour that they give depending on your engagement rating or whatever. They have this new thing, so gives you an idea.
Can you give us a rough number of like what the dollars are, or do you not have that information?
I don't have the information yet, but that's a rough like estimate, you know, if you do those numbers.
So how many million minutes again did you say?
We're averaging like the last 3 or 4 weeks we've been averaging about 7.5 million minutes a week.
7.5 million minutes a
week.
Which
is about 125,000 hours. So
125,000 hours.
Does Indie Rights recoup?
By 10,
what's that?
9%.
I'm just, while Ulrich did the math, I was going to ask a question.
Oh, so that's like roughly $10,000 in, that's a week?
Yeah, probably less than that because it's less than 10 cents. So it's like maybe, I'm not
that
sure.
Was
like
eight, that was 8%. That was 8 cents.
Yeah. It's anywhere, actually, I think it's anywhere from like 4 to like 7 cents an hour or something. So I think that's the range that it would be. And then, wow, and then Indie Rights takes 20% off of that.
So if it's 8,000 a week for 8 weeks, that's like, dude, that's pretty good.
It actually
minus 20%.
That's really rough because the last 4 weeks we've been at that high number, and it's like kind of risen slowly over that time. So, you know, I would probably say it's, you know,
a little bit less, like less than that.
It'd be less than that, yeah.
And also, there's no upfront fee, right? So they're going to recoup those costs, the cost to create the deliverables for you.
No. They don't charge that. That's the great thing about them. They don't charge those upfront fees. So
right, but they don't recoup them.
No, they don't recoup them. They, you know, you have to give them. You know, you still give them, you know, your movie according to the specs that they need. you know, that's your job. But like,
but you're not paying them to encode it in a lab.
Right. That's right.
Okay.
Well, and they're not providing posters or marketing materials. You're doing that all on your own.
Yeah, they do some. They do some limited marketing, and they'll also like, you know, if you ask them to like send it out to like LA Times, if you do a theatrical run, they'll send out to like local LA Times, Hollywood Reporter, whatever. But yeah, they have their own social media marketing, their own limited marketing. But other than that, yeah, they won't go out and do a big campaign for a film.
So I did the math that you just told me, and I got down minus the 20% cost. It's like $52,000, and like you're saying, it's going to be less than that because those numbers that you gave me were only for the last few weeks. But yeah, like, let's say like even if it's just $30,000, that's still huge because if it's $30,000 on your, you know, streaming, and then you have the whatever it was, $25,000 from the, you know, those 6 weeks,
right?
Like that's already over $50,000. That's half of your budget in like, you know, that opening. That's a great, man.
Yeah, that's where we're hopeful that we keep it up.
And that doesn't even count international, right? Because that hasn't happened yet.
I'm not sure how it works. I think it's available on Amazon Prime internationally, but like they haven't secured any international deals.
Do they have all rights? They have all territories, all rights.
Yeah.
Other than theatrical, which you do yourself.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
And they'll probably be taking it to AFM this year to sell, I imagine.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. So then you might be getting another like little chunk for each market they're able to sell it in. And like those markets vary between like $5,000 to $10,000. I don't know if that's still accurate, but that's what it used to be. So you might be able to get another like, you know, nice big chunk of money by the end of the year.
It'd be, yeah. I mean, I think that the international market's tricky, so I'm not sure exactly how, you know, because there was actually a time where like selling to China was, there's a lot of opportunities there, but now with the tariffs and everything, it's tougher. But,
right.
You know, it's like, I remember when I made my other film, it was like international markets was definitely something that the international TV market was a great way to like get some extra money. But now everything is changing. I don't even know what's going on, like what people buy nowadays.
There's also like a pretty big infatuation in Europe with American national parks.
Yeah.
So I feel like you're going to hook some people in with that alone. Yeah. Because, you know, people are flying from all over the world to go to these places.
Yeah, that's what I'm hoping, that we can like hook that audience in for sure.
Do you credit that with the film success? Is it the fact that you did a low budget film, but you still, you know, garnered these like fabulous locations? Or is there some other aspect to the film, do you think, that's bringing people in?
There's a lot of things that are going on that, like, you know, when I started, first of all, I think that the base of it is that we were able to make a good film that connected with people, and that like there's something about the landscape that we shown, and the character of Joe and his relationship with Amelia that like people connect with and understand. As far as like, I think there's, for a lot of people, there is this like yearning to like go out and see these amazing places that they see in movies and TV and pictures and Instagram and their friends going to, but they just don't do it because of life, you know, or because of their impediments or their socioeconomic reasons or whatever. And so like, this movie kind of speaks to that kind of wanderlust, I think, and also that kind of like thing that everyone wants to do, but like they don't do it. I think a lot of that goes for a lot of us, as far as like, you know, there's always something, some way we want to live our life or we want to do something. And just because of the way life works out, it hasn't happened that way yet. So I think that's what I'm hearing from a lot of people when they watch the film and see it. And then the other parts of it is just like you said, the landscape. Like, I think little things like the poster or the Find Me that's set in, you know, we just happened to take this picture in the Narrows at like, with the main character on the rock and these towering canyon walls and the colors, like people see that and go, wow, that's interesting. That's kind of what hooks them in. And then the trailer that we used, I also do, I do promos and trailers on the side as well. I cut this trailer, and when we were testing targeted ads in Facebook, people were telling me, oh, you know, you should probably do something less, if you're doing video, do something less than 30 seconds because of people's attention spans. I'm like, okay. So we tested a 30-second video, a minute trailer, and a minute and a half trailer. And to our surprise, it came back that overwhelmingly the most people that were engaged with the ad watched the 90-second trailer. And so I think there's something about the trailer also that connects with the people that get them to even watch the film.
Right.
And so, you know, and that trailer speaks to those themes I was talking about before that I think that people, why people like the film. And then when people actually watch the film, I think they actually like it, which helps because they tell other people. And then, so, you know, I would attribute things like the Outside Magazine article, for example, got a lot of our audience in. The Facebook ad got a lot of people in. And then also once it started going well on Amazon started recommending it to a lot of people as well. And then we've ended up on the top dramas list in the top popular titles list. And so I think that also just gets people interested in seeing it. And I think that and then once they see it again, like, I think they actually like it, which helps.
Nice.
You know, I think the main thing I realized a long time ago after my first two films is like, our film exists in a vacuum. The main thing for little indie films like this is that, you know, people got to know about the film. And so, you know, even if you have like a great theater you're showing at, like, no one knows about it, no one's going to see it. And so, you know, anything you could do to like get people, a specific audience especially, to actually know the film exists, then you have a chance to maybe succeed. But if you can't get people to not know about the film, then it'll just be stuck in this bottle.
So before we talk about social media marketing, which I really want to get into, let's talk about your theatrical screening.
I was going to ask about that too.
From my experience, my first two films, I realized that, like, and also talking to Julia Caruso, who produced
Columbus.
Yeah. Who's a amazing person, amazing producer. And, you know, she actually, I'm just so grateful that she just spent a little time with me just to talk about their experience. And also reading the Sundance thing that Liz,
the case study that Jess Fuselier wrote.
Yes. You should definitely, everyone out there should definitely check that out, because it really shows, like, you know, how difficult it is to get people in seats for theatrical. But at the same time, theatrical, any sort of theatrical is a great marketing tool, because you get like, you know, we got a lot of write-ups from LA Times, Hollywood Reporter, you know, all these things that needed a 1 week long screening to like qualify for them to even look at the film for a review. In addition, like, it helps, you know, helps you just show international people, like, hey, this had like a theatrical debut, and also help social media talk about your theatrical exhibition. And also it qualifies you for things like Film Independent Spirits Awards and things like that. So I think that, like, if you're going to do a four wall like we did, you need to look at it as a marketing expense and not as a moneymaker. Columbus is kind of a bad example because
it's an outlier.
Yeah, it ended up making most of his money in theatrical, but Julia told me specifically, like, it was very painful. You know, it's like gambling, you know, $30 to win like five. That's just the background of what we decided about theatrical. So,
how many theaters did you end up four-walling? Was it just one?
Yeah, or? Absolutely. Just we four-walled a Lemley Theater for a week. And even though...
Which Lemley? Just out of curiosity.
The music hall.
Okay, gotcha.
In Beverly Hills.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and we decided that was a good place because it was more central than... I mean, you know, they have other theaters that are...
And then how did you get reviewers to come to see the movie?
During the film festival circuit, I was able to get like three or four reviews just from film festivals, from just calling every publication that was in near that film festival to see if they would discover it. And I was very fortunate. I got like three or four reviews just from that. And on top of that, they were Rotten Tomato critics. So they counted toward 100% Rotten Tomatoes reading. And then for the LA screening, I have a PR friend who works with independent films, Dave Magdell. And so I knew that he was really great with Asian American filmmakers as well as just indie films. And so we worked out a very limited scope where he would like get it out to reviewers in the LA area for the theatrical. And so my films before, I actually went to the LA Times and Hollywood Reporter and Variety myself and asked them. And when I four-walled before, and they were actually review the film still. So, you know, you could do it yourself if you want, but again, that's just more time that takes off, you know, off your life. So, you know, if you can find a good PR person, I would highly recommend it.
Wait, who is your PR person? Who is it?
Dave McAdell.
Oh, Dave very McAdell. Fancy. Yes.
Yeah. Since I've screened a lot of films at the Los Angeles Asian American Film Festival, he and I become friends, and so he really is a great champion of independent film and also Asian American film. So, you know, we hired him, but he made it work out so we could do within our budget.
Well, I mean, I have selfish reasons for continuing on this topic because I'm trying to decide what scope of theatrical I'm going to do for myself.
Well, this is
please
what I
go
would,
on. Yeah.
That's what I tell you. Is that like, so that was, we end up being the top. Oh, the other thing I did also is like, I happened to have another friend who was releasing his independent feature. And so we split the four wall. And that split our cost in half, and we still got two screenings a day. And that was immensely helpful as far as the costs. So I would highly recommend that if you can, because again, we were together, we were the top grossing screen for that week, and we still didn't make our money back. So it's just very difficult to get people
in. And then how many advertising did you do for the four wall?
I just did social media ads and also the PR. So we got a lot of, I got a bunch of interviews, some publications around Asian American and regular. And so that's basically what we did. But what I found, Liz, is that like a lot of interest, even after our release now, of people wanting to screen the film because of the, you know, it's kind of like a big screen kind of experience.
Mm-hmm. Oh, of course. That makes sense for you guys. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, in fact, you had told me like at the forum, you had suggested like, hey, why don't you do a hike and then at the end, like show the film,
yes,
and, you know, at the end of the hike, which actually logistically is very difficult. But I started like reaching out to people around outdoor groups, and people are like, yeah, we want to screen this film. And so we have like 12 about 12 cities of groups and those 12 cities are interested in screening the film and just set up a screening. And so that is going to be like our actual theatricals, like a year long, just kind of tour. Most of them are one-time screenings. But still it's like, you know, it's just a little bit of chunk of money that hopefully we'll add together. And then like randomly, like we recently, indie theater in Corvallis, Dark Side Cinema. I don't know if you've heard of them. They're a great little indie theater, but they heard about the film when we screened outdoors in Eugene, Oregon, and they said, hey, yeah, we'll do a 1 week run of this. And I'm like, okay. And so I sent them the film, and then it ended up doing so well, and it ended up running for 3 weeks. And so I think you also find if you just call like a lot of these indie theaters and just explain, like, you know, show how well your film is done, or like explain, like, you know, that they'll listen. And so you could like book theaters that way without four-walling. Yeah, definitely. All the screenings you're going to be doing is like screenings where we're not going to put up any money. It's like, that's the main thing. We're not going to put up any money. If someone's going to help us put it up there, then yeah, that's great. That's how we're going to do it. That's basically how theatrical has worked out for us.
Unsolicited suggestion for your hike/screenings is Easy
Yes.
Adventures.
Yes.
Easy Adventures with Find Me. That's my unsolicited suggestion. So why four wall then? That's where I'm stuck with, because I am booking my own theatrical and I'm booking actual rev shares with the theater. And I'm just wondering why you decided to go the four wall route. And maybe do we define things on this podcast? Should we define things? Is it weird if we define? Okay. But
I don't think so. Yeah. I think that's.
But like you're essentially reserving the theater for a week and paying for all expenses to screen your film and then getting all the money to you rather than a booking with a rev share, which would be splitting the ticket sales with the exhibitor. Right.
Yeah.
What went into that, your decision? And sorry, Ulrich, if this gets way too theatrically nerdy.
No, this is good. I want to know like hard numbers, like how much does it cost a four wall? And then how much did you get back too? That's like another part of this.
Liz, to answer your question, like I just found it like for a very small film like mine that didn't have any sort of, you know, didn't go to any big festivals or anything, like. For my last film, I called around the theaters and they just weren't interested. You know, it's like they didn't have any in the Los Angeles area anyway. And they had plenty of other films to choose from that they, you know, if they didn't have any sort of like backing behind it somehow, that they just weren't interested. And so I didn't think anyone would be interested actually in booking the film just from my festival run. I would love to talk to you about like how you will go about it. So I could.
I only made one booking so far, so yeah. It's like it's not a success story for me yet, and I haven't tried LA. That's why I keep asking you about four walling in LA because I'm very nervous about making an LA booking. That's scary.
Yeah, but that's the thing is that like that's why you know if you look at it as a marketing expense as opposed to like. You know, put it in your marketing budget, then it's a lot easier to like to decide to do it. And so, you know, I think Lemony charged us like $6,000 and we split it in half. So it ended up being $3,000 and we ended up making $2,000. So, you know, that's numbers that we had for it.
But you know, like $1,000 for a four wall seems pretty inexpensive.
Yeah. You know, that's a thing is like whatever you do to do that. But like, I would say, Liz, that like, first, try to see if you get a booking because you have a track record. And then if not, then, you know, if you think LA is a big market for you to like to exhibit in, don't be afraid to four wall. I mean, I don't think it's gotten more expensive than before, but it's still like, you know, I think it's a great marketing expense. It has a lot of positives to it.
And I just realized, sorry.
Where did you book your theatrical booking?
I mean, my first booking at the Roxy in San Francisco, and we're playing in December.
Yay. Awesome.
Yeah, yay. I'm really
Roxy,
excited.
Roxy. And Roxy's a great theater.
Yeah, and also, like, that means I go up to the Marin and I get childcare because my parents live in Marin. So it's nice.
And I get to go see the movie in the theater because I live in San Francisco.
That's right. I should just do a whole Bay Area thing. That would be fun. I just realized Tom, we didn't ask you about this, but you're essentially also doing something not backwards, but very creatively in the sense that you did four wall. Now you're digital and then you're going and doing a theatrical tour after all of this, which is kind of unheard of.
Yeah.
And I know we want to get into more costs and nitty gritty stuff, but you said that doesn't involve like that doesn't cost you any money, right? To do this tour.
Yeah.
And what is the mentality of it just to continue to spread the word about the film?
If we can make altogether from the tour, like, I don't know, $2,500 to $5,000, like that all goes into the pot of making our money back. And plus, I think it's a great marketing tool as well, just to have a screening and talk about it and people talk it up to other people and like people get more awareness of the film and, hey, I'll check it out on Prime, you know, and in particular, you know, most of these groups are either like, are usually someone involved with the outdoors. And so like, you know, that's a group we want to talk to. And so even if they don't come see the screening, they'll hear about it in their area. So, you know, that's a positive for us. So, and then, you know, the other thing too is just, I've also been doing talks at REI stores across Southern California about the hikes in the film. And it was great that like these local REI stores are willing to have me come in. But also, you know, at these other cities, I could do, you know, I talk to the REI stores there and see if they want me to do a talk there. And that's just another marketing thing to go with the tour. Yeah. So that's the way I kind of look at it.
Question about the tour.
Yeah.
Maybe I missed this, but are you splitting ticket sales with the groups that you're partnering with for these screenings?
It depends. It depends on the situation. Like, you know, some situations it's like it's a group who actually are just sponsoring the event. And so they'll give me a screening fee. And then some groups, you know, they'll have a box office and then we'll talk about splitting box office.
Okay. So you're either getting a screening fee or you're splitting ticket sales.
That's right.
Nice. Awesome. That's smart. And then, I really, really want to know like how much you're spending on your social media marketing and how you decide to like allocate those funds.
In my research and talking with, that I've done online and also like talking to people like at the forum and other filmmakers, it's like, first of all, I was told that like, as far as distribution and marketing budget, like you should take your budget and double it. And so like, we kind of like did that.
Oh shit.
Yeah. People.
Damn.
But people were telling me like, you have to spend at least $30,000. I was like, I can't spend $30,000. And so I didn't know, I was like, okay, let's just see where this goes. I'm not sure how this is going to turn out. So I budgeted $10,000, for just for social media ads.
Okay.
And then as I saw that things were going well for the film, going well with the social media ads, we upped it to about $15,000. So this is over about a four month period. And so definitely it's been, you know, front loaded. A lot of it was spent in the beginning and less is being spent now. But that's
and then is this all Facebook or are you doing it across multiple platforms?
Well, Facebook, you know, owns Instagram. So the way it works is like you could have Facebook decide where the best place to do the ads, or you could like pick, you know, either Facebook, you know, mobile, Facebook like messaging or Instagram. At first, like we did some test ads and we just let Facebook decide and we noticed that it was all going to Facebook people. This seems like something that would be a great Instagram kind of ad because people on Instagram just love pictures of the wilderness as we found. So I just tested just on Instagram and it turns out like Instagram was like not doing as well as Facebook. So like whatever, their Facebook robot was definitely more smarter than I was. From then on, I just let Facebook, the bot, like decide where they're going to send the ads. And it ended up working pretty well. And I guess it kind of makes sense that like we noticed that like our audience was like skewing like a little bit older, like, you know, 35 to 60, as opposed to like, you know, and that's Facebook kind of skews older than Instagram. So that kind of makes sense. And so, yeah, that's what we did. We did a lot of, I had a friend, again, another friend. This is all about finding friends. I have a friend who does digital marketing for nonprofits. So he came on board to help me out and just consulted with me as far as like how to set them up and like kind of look at the numbers and give me some ideas of what the numbers mean. And so we tested different ads. We tested different trailers, like I was talking about. We tested different audiences as well. And by audiences, I mean not age, but like test audiences by, you know, their keywords or their likes. And so, you know, we started testing out like national parks and certain national parks and like REI and like hiking and like Asian American film and like indie film. And after all the kind of testing, we found that like the sweet spot was like people that like national parks or people that like REI and North Face. Like,
oh, products, that's funny.
You know, things like that. And so like we end up making two sets of ads, end up finding out that 90-second ad was the best. And so we end up doing the 90-second ad to those two different targets. And that's what's been working well for us.
So stupid question, but then is that those two ads that you hone down, are those the ones you just keep on replaying that ad over and over again to different markets over time? Or do you do multiple different types of ads that you just put money into?
In the beginning, it was like a lot of different multiple ads because we're testing them. And then also Facebook has a feature where you could do a head-to-head thing where you could put out two ads at once and it'll track how well each one does and then tell you which one is the best out of those two. But people have told me that, like, my digital marketers told me that it also takes a while for their algorithm to figure out what the best efficient way to get out to the right audience is. So after we did a bunch of multiple ads, we just stuck to two different ads to one ad to two different target audiences and let the algorithm kick in.
Oh, wow. So it's just one ad to different audiences.
Yeah, that's what we found out worked out best for us. But like Okay. Now, if I want to continue, and I don't know if I do because we've kind of like, you know, trying to figure out how much more money we were willing to put into the ads since we've kind of like exhausted our budget. It's like, do we want to, now we can either go back to people that have engaged with the ad and like do a different ad for them or, you know, do a different campaign. I don't know, because definitely it feels like now that like this particular campaign has gone for a long time and, you know, now I gotta sit down with my digital person and say, is it smart now to keep doing ads or have we reached our peak?
Right. And then when you're doing this, I'm really asking these questions because I might be doing this for myself soon, but like, do you put like $5,000 into like an ad to one market and then you just say schedule over whatever, 6 weeks? Or is it like you're running that same ad multiple times through different posts, like with less dollar amounts to that ad?
The way I've been doing it is I go week by week and see how things go by each week. So I'll take an ad and like say, okay, run this ad to these two groups. And then, you know, put in like say $500 for the week and let's see where that takes us. And then I'll get back to numbers and see if it, you know, how well people responded to it. So basically I do by the week and see how well they do per week.
So Tom,
yes.
Earlier this week we spoke to someone who made $500,000 movie and then did an eventized theatrical run. And we learned from her about her transactional numbers. And then a few days later we talked to a micro budget filmmaker who makes films for $3,000.
Wow.
And no matter what, always makes a profit and just wants to keep on churning out the work.
Yeah.
So you're in this space in between them, and we're both in very similar budget levels, by the way. That's, you know, so I clearly have a horse in this race, and the horse is to support this kind of model. But I was curious, is this your plan to keep on making movies at the 100K range? Is it to go bigger? What is sustainable? What do you think is the right goal?
I think you and I have kind of like talked about this, and I see it from your Facebook posts. I don't know. I mean, I think it's very, you know, this is very doable for anyone to do for our budget range. But as a lifestyle, I don't know if this is sustainable. In fact, I would say this is not sustainable for like sanity, you know, to like do your own marketing, right? The reason I think we're able to like be able to make a profit on this, hopefully, knock on wood, is that like I've done everything. Right. And then my producers helped, and like other people have helped too. And I've asked for a lot of favors and help. And so like, how much can we do that every time for a film? I don't know, you know? So, and the other thing too, is like, you know, I've been working so hard on this marketing and all this other stuff. Like I haven't had a chance to like get on these other two projects that I want to get off the ground and that do the thing that I really want to do, which is writing and directing. And so if I could make a film like this where I find this audience and that like it does this well, then yeah, I'd love to be able to do that. And then also just, you know, put some money into hiring other people to take care of this other stuff. But, you know, the question is like, is this a one-off? Like, you know, did I find like this the perfect like storm, or like, can I do this again? I mean, as we know, like, you know, filmmaking, it's a gamble. It's like, you know, we're just like, even if we have the greatest film, it's like, if we don't get the perfect things kind of don't come together, people might not watch it. Even with films that made the Sundance, you know,
right.
I would say if someone could guarantee me that like, we could like do this well, if we keep thinking, you know, thinking it out in the right way, I would love to keep doing that because of the creative control and like, you know, the kind of like hands-on and everything kind of aspect of it. On the other hand, it's like, if I had to like keep kicking my own ass and killing myself to like do this, like, you know, I would love to be able to just make a film that someone funds and like I could just concentrate on making movies and like have other people deal with this other thing of marketing and distributing. So if I, you know, if that means making a film that I could have a bigger budget, of course I would love to do that. But of course, finding people to fund your films is probably the most difficult thing out of all of this to at least get things started.
Have you always self-funded all your films? You said you self-funded this one, but did you self-fund the other two also?
Yeah, I did.
Wow. Have you ever tried to get investors for your films?
Yeah, that's the thing. I did for Dealing with Dad. This is the one that went to the Screenwriters Lab at Film Independent. I had a great producer on board and I had a great casting director. And so, you know, I thought that, okay, let's see if we can make this work as far as like finding funding. People seemed to really like the script. It was just, you know, that we go out to people and try to get people attached. It'd take forever and it wasn't working. And so, yeah, I have tried. It's just very difficult, you know, and
right.
I'm not getting any younger. It's just like, you know, for Find Me, actually I made Find Me because it was getting so hard to find funding for Dealing with Dad. Because I just said to myself, I need to make a movie. I can't sit around and just like, you know, wait for this. Like I want to make a movie I can make now so I could just keep being a better filmmaker. That's when I decided, you know, just, I just need to do this. And so we set this micro budget and shot it over a year so that we could afford to do it. We could still work our day jobs and make this. And it ended up working out pretty well for us actually, because we would shoot 3 or 4 days a month. And then I would edit the footage, you know, during that month. And then the scenes would be done by the time we shot the next scenes. And so by the end of the year, we had basically had a rough cut ready to go. So that actually ended up working out for us.
That was the other thing I was curious about. I was like, what is your day job? Are you like a freelancer just doing a bunch of different things? You said you do editing trailers. You do what kind of work do you do?
I'm a freelance producer, writer, editor, director. So yeah, I just go out and you know, whoever needs whatever job, whether it's someone that does everything, producer, writer, editor, or someone just in a writer or editor or producer, then I'll do that as well. Yeah, I've been able to like, knock on wood, just been able to cobble together, hustle enough jobs over the past few years to keep things going.
Nice. That's what I do. So I do producing, editing, and shooting are my three freelance jobs that I make money on. Yeah. And I just bounce from job to job.
Yep.
Basically.
You and I in the same boat.
Yeah. But I mean, it's been working pretty well, you know, and I always think about getting a full-time job and the 9-to-5 and trying to, maybe that will give me more time to work on my movies, but I don't know, and be like more secure, but I kind of feel like, yeah, maybe the freelance thing, maybe that just works.
Yeah. I think definitely being freelance is great because I could work and then I could work on my own stuff on the side. But then, you know, I do have a family. So like, as Liz probably knows too, it's just like, you know,
it's the worst.
Yeah.
It's the worst and the best at the same time.
Yeah. Exactly. and so like, you know, I mean, I've had like full-time jobs before, you know, doing producing, editing, and also I've written for 4 network sitcoms. But definitely it's like, it does sap away, you know, your energy and
not if they have boundaries. I've been lucky to be able to find jobs that are 40 hours a week.
That's great.
And I think that's the only solution. Yeah. You can't work in development and go to drinks at like from like 7 to 11 every night,
right,
you know,
exactly.
Whatever it is. Like you have to have a job that allows you to turn off a little bit. So you have mornings, evenings, and weekends.
Right. And I'm sure you both find it like these kind of jobs. Also, you just meet other people that are interested in making movies. And so it does, it does help to, you know, to have this network of friends that can do, you know, cool stuff.
What's next, man? Like after you've gone through these three experiences with these features, you've had the most success doing this thing that you don't necessarily want to do for your life. Like you don't want to be a marketer forever, but you did a good job at it, obviously. What is your plan? Like, are you going to try to replicate this sort of model you did with Find Me? Or are you going to go out and like now with all this proof and this firepower, like try to raise money more of like back with some of the people who've told you no before and do it that way for your next film?
You know, I definitely have projects I'm ready to go with. I have like three projects that I'm looking to get off the ground. So there's this Dealing With Dad project I told you about with the Film Independent Screenwriters Lab. You know, I think that it's about an Asian American family dealing with a depressed dad who's an asshole, and who's actually nicer depressed than well. And so it's kind of like The Farewell, and it's kind of more like Nebraska, one of my favorite Alexander Payne films. But it's centered around an Asian American family.
And also a great football team.
Yeah, and also a go Huskers. But like, you know, unlike Find Me, which has this very specific outdoors audience, I don't know if Dealing With Dad has a very specific audience. I mean, obviously Asian American, but I don't know, having other films, Asian American themed films, like, I don't know if I could depend on that as far as like an audience to target. With that in mind, I don't know if I could go with the same model with this film that I can with that end up working with Find Me. And so that's been very difficult for me. The Farewell obviously has done very well. I'm so happy to see a film like that do well. But, you know, I think also the fact that it got into Sundance really helped. And also the fact that, you know, A24 bought it for $7 million, you know, helped its prospects. But like, is my film going to get into Sundance? You know, you can't bank on that. So that's one project I'm mulling over. Like, you know, I'm definitely going to make it. Like, but I think in one more, I'm going to have to make it for like, you know, under $100,000 and just make it, because it's kind of film I can make just choosing a house. The other project I'm working on, of course, is like a sequel to Find Me. That we found this audience, engaged audience who loves the film and also loves the message. I don't know if it's going to be a direct sequel or just a similar film about the outdoors, but I'm working on that story now. And like, I found that there's also like a lot of outdoor companies are very interested in getting involved in helping sponsor a film like that, either with goods or with, you know, actual sponsorships. And so I went to the outdoor retailers market with Find Me and talked to a lot of these people, and they're like, hey, this looks great. I wish you came to me before you shot the film, because we can't really help you now.
Oh, wow. Like, what would they have helped you with? Like, you know, with actual funds?
Yes. So some were, you know, could help me with actual sponsorship with the film after the film was done, like sponsor screenings and sponsor like, you know, a tour or whatever. Others could just help with products, you know, and also product placement. You know, we could discuss those kind of things. I know I've talked to the outdoor filmmakers who have gotten that done. So that's good to know. And plus, you know, knowing that there's this outdoors film audience is hungry for this kind of material, for narrative material, not just documentaries about, you know, guys who climb up face walls without ropes and almost kill themselves.
Right.
You know, that's helpful to know too. So that's another project that I think that we could like, that we can like, you know, look into like, you know, following this kind of model to make it work. And then the third project I'm working on is a film noir set in the internment, the Japanese internment camps in World War II.
Wow.
That we want to shoot in black and white and all that kind of stuff. And I think that...
So that'll be even more expensive because the period piece and all that.
Right. But I think that that film actually has a lot of aspects of it that we could actually, that's sellable or to get it funded more so than my other film.
And so do you have management or an agent or any of that stuff?
No, I had one when I was working for TV and then lost them. And so now I'm actually actively looking for a manager. In fact,
feels like you're a really good catch because you got three features. You've got marketability. You've got a proven track record of making money back on your feature with some actual hard numbers. You know, I feel like you're the perfect person.
You would think that, wouldn't you? But
I do think that.
You know, I've talked to some managers and, you know, they just don't, unless like, you know, the film got picked up by an actual studio. It's like, it's been a hard ride.
I don't know. To me, it's like, you're at this opportunity, right?
Yeah.
You have this opportunity to really push yourself out to this other echelon in a way. And I think it would start with getting representation. So I feel like if I were you, that would be my play. Like, you know, it's like, I have these three projects. That are all ready to go. There's good things about each one of them that can make them more, you know, makeable and doable and marketable, you know, in their own ways. And I don't know. I feel like that would be like the time to seize that, basically.
Yeah.
Would be now.
That's what I'm hoping. I mean, I'm actually reaching out and inquiries with a lot of management companies right now, just going one by one and seeing if they will really look at my stuff. And so gotten some people looking at my stuff. We'll see if that works out to anything, but I'm just in the process now. And it's, you know, just another indie filmmaker thing to deal with, the hope that we can get together. So
I guess the last question is, like, going through all this experience and making these films, you know, and being in the same position roughly that you were before, except you have way more ammunition, obviously. Mm-hmm. Will you just keep on making another, like, movies? Like, if, like, you know, you don't get a manager, you don't get any support, you don't raise money, are you just going to go on and keep on doing this? Or do you see, like, the ending to this path that you've been on?
I really hope so. And that's what I plan to do. You know, we'll see where life takes me on this. I would love to just keep making, you know, I've loved doing a mix of things. I love to, like, direct for other people, write for other people, you know, get paid to do it, and also just continue making small films like this. Because, like, I think there, when you get hired as an actual director or writer, you know, that's, you have a client that you're actually working for, which is, you know, which is great.
Right.
You know, you're getting paid. But, like, to be able to also just work on something that is fully yours and fully your vision, I think that helps you get through working these other jobs, and also just makes you, like, you know, just kind of happier that, you know, at least, you know, there's one project, you know, you're going to make it your way. There's great opportunities too, but, like, at least it allows you to, like, feel like, okay, I could deal with working with other people's, making sure I get other people's visions right, but also I could also be working on something that's my own thing. So I think that, you know, as time goes on, and I hope that I will be continue to, like, just work my own thing as well as working on things for other people.
Yeah. I mean, my whole thesis statement for my career and life as a filmmaker is to basically just keep on doing it myself.
Yeah.
So, like, get this first feature done and then make my next feature and my next feature and my next feature. And if I never, you know, get that support, you know, from, like, a manager and an agent or a producer who wants to fund my project or whatever it is, that I'll just keep on doing it the way that I've been doing it and just push myself forward, you know?
Yeah.
And hopefully get better at raising money and hopefully be making money back from my investors on my previous project so that they'll want to reinvest in me on the next one.
Yeah.
But, like, you know, I just feel like this is the life that a filmmaker should be prepared for, is to be kind of doing it all on your own, because, and I don't think anyone's coming to save us here, you know?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
And it needs to be like this, like, you have to make it sustainable one way or another, even if it is, like, you're just funding your own movies, like, maybe you make enough money where that's a sustainable thing that you can just keep on doing, you know?
Yeah, I agree. And I think that I came to a realization a while ago that, like, you know, what makes us filmmakers is not, you know, some contract you have with, you know, with Sony Studios or whatever. You know, what makes you a filmmaker is you're making films. You know, you're actually making something and showing people things you're making. And when you're doing that, then you're a filmmaker, you know, and if you stop doing that, then that's really when you've stopped.
You're not making films anymore.
Exactly. You know? And so with that in mind, it's just like, you know, for filmmakers out there, it's like, you know, don't let this whole like getting hired or like getting paid or whatever, which is of course important, but make a movie, you know, whether it be a 5-minute short or, you know, a 2-hour feature or whatever, make a movie. And then you could, I think you'd definitely, you know, you'll call yourself a filmmaker and that's who you are.
Yeah, absolutely. Inspiring words, man. So I think we should wrap things up here. Where should they find your work? What should they do? What do you want our audience to, how do you want them to find you?
Well, right now, you can find me on Amazon Prime. It's also available for download and rental on Amazon Prime. It's also available on Google Play and on Tubi TV. Also available on DVD and Blu-ray. We just released this week on Blu-ray and DVD, actually.
Oh, nice.
With extras if you like the film, like commentary and that kind of stuff.
And where can you get the Blu-ray and the DVD? Is it all just through Amazon.com through your website?
Any of the major digital markets like Amazon, Walmart, Best Buy. It's on there. Just look up Find Me. There's actually been a bunch of the films called Find Me. So look for Find Me with Tom Hwang or Find Me About. But yeah, that's where you can get it.
Nice. And really, really quick, did that come through Indie Rights doing the Blu-ray release?
Yes. That's part of the thing.
Oh, nice.
So yeah.
Part of their deal. And did they put that whole package together or did you have to put it together and deliver it to them?
You had to put it together and deliver it to them. But there's no upfront cost still though. So like, you know, you just give them, you have to deliver them the materials, but everything else they take care of.
And then also the duplication and all that?
Yeah, it's actually, there's new technology now where they send it to a company that actually makes discs on demand.
There's
no need for like, you know, buying a bunch of pre-made discs now. It's like, you know, the way they found a system or a company that does that.
So did you have to make one or did you just send all the assets to that company and they just take care of it?
Yeah, you just send assets. You can send one that they could duplicate. That works too. But, you know, if you have a DVD maker or if you know how to do it yourself, which I did, you create an ISO and, you know, a file and send a DVD file and they'll encode it. And then you also have to like make up the sleeve and everything as well.
So you do the art and all that stuff and the ISO and then you deliver that and then they take it from there. Oh yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah,
man. I've done that for my own films too, doing the whole ISO and making the Blu-ray or the DVD.
Yeah.
And then doing the art. And I have a bunch for my first short film in my office.
Oh wow.
I just sit there. But that's awesome, man. I like this Indie Rights. These guys sound cool. it sounds like a really good way to go for self-distribution, because it's like sort of, it is self-distribution, but it's not really, because like they're helping you, but they're just taking a little bit off your plate and then, you know, just taking 20%. It's like, that's nice, man.
Yeah. I mean,
I like that.
And then they really, I mean, they call themselves Indie Rights, but I think they really are looking to like, you know, be like a spokes company or whatever for small indie films. And so they're really helpful and really smart. Whatever they're getting into as far as digital distribution platforms, they've researched it and you know, are going into something that's well thought out, which I think is helpful.
And they're not like these other companies, you know, like Film Nation or whatever, that just take any movie. Like they are selective on the movies that they take.
Yeah. If you go to their website, you could like submit your film to them via the website. You don't have to have any sort of rep or anything.
Nice.
But they are selective about the films they pick.
Nice. Awesome. All right. Well, Tom, thanks for a fantastic episode.
Sure.
It's so great to talk to you. I could ask you a lot more questions about Facebook marketing, and maybe I will off air
because
I want to learn. But if you want to check out our website, you can go to makingmoviesishard.com.
Cool.
Where you can find links to the things we talked about on this episode. If you want to get in contact with us, you can also send an email to podcast@makingmoviesishard.com, or you can find us Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. I am at MMIH Podcast. I'm Ulrich B on Twitter and Instagram, and Liz can be found at Liz Manischel on all things, I believe. Also, my film The Alternate is on social media too. You guys should be checking that out. Woo. That's at The Alternate Film, and then on Twitter it's at Alternate Film 1. Yes, that's right. So it's The Alternate Film for Facebook and for Instagram, and Twitter is Alternate Film 1. Watch the teaser trailer. I'd love to know what people think of that. And yeah, you can also leave a review for us on iTunes or Stitcher, which we don't get very many of. We'd love more of those. And Tom, thanks for an ops episode, man.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
All right, talk to you guys next week.
All right, take care.
All right. It is time for the segment that you all love. You're the expert. What's the You're the Expert, you say? Is this your very first time listening to the podcast? I sure hope it's not on a throwback episode, but if it is, this is what it is. It's a segment that our producer, Eric Toms, has invented where he collects questions and just different questions, they're just questions. I was trying to say there's something better than questions, but they are actually just questions. He collects different questions from listeners, people on Twitter, emails, whatever, in his life, filmmakers he speaks to, questions he has, and he puts them all together and he makes a list. And then these are questions he asks us for You're the Expert. And these are all things that he thinks that we are the experts on. So he thinks that we will have the definitive answer to this question that this person asked. So we do get to read these ahead of time. So we have done a little bit of prep. Here is this week's You're the Expert question. And Liz is going to answer first. Hey, all, I am a filmmaker and I have made a number of projects, but with no real financial success. That's probably going to sound familiar to a lot of you. I went to film school and moved to Los Angeles. Although I've made terrific projects with my very talented friends and entertainment professionals, it's become clear that I'm never going to make a financial living as a filmmaker. You're down on yourself, whoever this person is. This is not a good mentality. My question is, when is there a clear sign I should quit? Liz, take it away.
Oh, there's so many different ways to take this. One is quit now if your only goal is to make money. quit right this second if that is your 100% reason why you're in the film industry. I want to support people who want to create art. I want to support people who have something to say and that those things are more primary to making money. I do not think it's wrong to want to make money, but if your primary goal is to make money, then go and make, you know, alien autopsy conspiracy theory YouTube videos and throw them on Tubi. Go follow Jason Horton, who is an artist, but also finds a way to create a career out of this. If your primary goal is to make money, go learn about TikTok marketing. Like, there's a million things to help exploit your career a little bit better than you may be doing. But my response to this is really do some soul searching and ask yourself, why did you want to become a filmmaker in the first place? Was it just to make a living? Because there are better ways to make a living than to be a filmmaker. Is it the luxury? Is it the excitement? Is it the glamour? I'd go in a different field for those things because it's too painful to make movies for that byproduct to be your main goal. But if it's to tell stories, to participate in community art, to have really, really expensive emotional catharsis and have a therapeutic experience, then never quit. Keep on making movies as long as it's useful, beneficial to you personally and professionally. But we've talked about this so much. Never expect to make a financial living unless you're being incredibly strategic about how you make your projects with a very specific bottom line. Ulrich, what about you?
Yeah, I don't know. I've been thinking about this a lot lately, not quitting, but just what is the success, you know, and what is the feeling of, you know, having made it and having achieved your goal, you know? This is kind of a side story, but I finished this huge project yesterday and it went extremely well. I got to see it on, you know, this conference. It was amazing motion graphics that I produced and worked on with the team intimately for 6-7 weeks. We got to see it's 30-40 foot screens, you know, with motion graphics going across all these screens and synced together and timed. And it was a thing of beauty. Client loved it. My company loved it. Everyone's happy. It was a massive, massive success. I'm walking away from the big celebratory dinner we had, you know, and I just feel this feeling of is that it? You know, is that all there is to it? I did it. Everything was perfect. And I feel empty now for some reason. And I had that same feeling when I won that award in Italy with The Alternate. I won the biggest award you could get at this film festival in Italy that I was flown to, paid all my room and board paid for, half my flight paid for, this whole thing. I won the award with my movie that I've been working on for 8 years. And I got a bottle of wine and I'm like in Italy by myself. And I'm just like walking around feeling like, is that it? Like, this is, I did it. I did exactly what I came here to do. I did the best thing that could have happened from this experience of going to this film festival. I won the festival and I feel empty. Like, what? Yeah. Like, why is that the feeling I have? It's so weird. I've been like working through that, you know, since. And I feel like, yeah, it's not like because I wasn't proud of it. I wasn't because it wasn't fun. It wasn't because it was like, you know, when you win, it's like almost if I'd gotten second place, I wonder if I'd have felt better than if I'd gotten first. But like, yeah, I don't know. Like, it's just I don't know if you understand what I'm talking about, if this makes any sense to you, but it was so weird. And I felt that again last night. And I was thinking about like, you know what, Ulrich, I think you just like the journey. Like, you like the journey and you like the process. You like the challenge. You like the struggle. I think that's gotta be what you like about this whole thing. Like, whether it's a movie or a corporate job, it's like, you like being in the shit. Like, that's what you enjoy. You don't enjoy winning. Like, why don't you enjoy? I don't know why I don't enjoy winning, but like, I like being in the mix. And then it's like, when the mix is over, I feel that like, oh, the mix as in like, yeah, when the movie isn't being made anymore and it's finished, like, then I feel this sense of like, oh, I want to be making something. But then when I win, I don't feel good either. It's like, why? I should enjoy the winning part more. But the whole point of what I'm trying to say is, if you're a whole reason why you're doing this is like what Liz said, is to make money, it's like, well, A, you're never going to make it, probably. You know, it's so, so hard to be financially successful as a filmmaker. But like, you should be in it for the journey. Like, the process of making the movies should be the thing that you get off on, that you like enjoy the most. Like, and it doesn't have to be like, Liz, you've talked about like, you don't like being on set, you know, that you love being in.
But I love editorial. I love post-production. Right.
So you don't have to love every part of it necessarily, because it is really hard, and some parts are way harder than others. But like, if you should be in it because you love part of the process, and it's addicting to you, and you can't stop doing it, and you can't stop telling your own stories, and you can't stop, you know, thinking about projects and wanting to make projects, and whether or not they make money or they win, you know, awards, or they get into film festivals or whatever, that all shouldn't matter. It all should matter is that you like the process of doing it. And I'm not saying that you shouldn't fight for those things, because that's like an incredibly important part of it. Like, you should be fighting for getting into film festivals and winning awards and like getting bigger audience, bigger strides, bigger everything. But like, whether or not you get those things should not like change your mind if you're going to make another movie or not. Like, you should just know, like the best place to be in is to just know you're going to keep doing it forever, and then not worry about like when you're going to make your next movie or like how many movies you're going to make, but just know that you're always going to be making something.
It's a calling. I think filmmaking is a calling. I really do. And
that's a good way of putting it. Yeah.
And I'm agnostic, you know, I'm not spiritual or religious, but I do think that something in your psyche, in your brain, calls you to it. And for me, it's very healthy to work out my problems in this kind of controlled setting of a film set, with the stories that I think are reflecting the art, but they're stories that are personal. So it's like, you're working out your problems. You're benefiting from it. Wait, just really briefly, I wanted to comment on what you were saying. Like, when you were in Italy, it's like, I wonder if the outcome can never be good enough. It's not that it's empty. It's just never good enough to reflect the amount of effort and heart and soul that you put into it. Like, what could ever match that? So maybe that's why you felt disappointed.
I don't know. I wonder if I ever won like, or like got a manager or like got a studio contract or got hired to, like, I wonder what I would feel then. Like, I think if I got like a manager or an agent or something, I probably would feel pretty good, because it meant that there's more work to do and that you have a lot of work that you can do to like make that successful. But like, I think like winning like an Oscar or something, I probably would have a similar thing. Like I don't know, maybe not. I would like to think not. I would like to think that I would be like really, you know, whatever. But like, I don't know. Like, it was just an interesting feeling that I had. You know, maybe part of it was because I was alone and I wasn't around. Like, my team wasn't there, and like I couldn't really celebrate with anybody. Maybe that was part of it. But like, yeah, I also just think like, I don't know, it's just something I need to work on. And it's not to say that I didn't enjoy it and I'm not proud of the movie or anything. It's just like, I feel like that feeling of like, like I want to be fulfilled when making a movie and like it's done, but I feel like I feel most fulfilled while making it and less fulfilled when it's over, I guess is probably. And then like a year later, like I think after, a year after the alternate was released, then I felt more fulfilled. But like when the movie just came out, like I think I didn't feel very fulfilled from that experience.
I get that. That's relatable.
That's weird
to me. Yeah. Well, before my tiny baby comes bursting through the door, is it relatable to out you? Is it relatable to any of you out there in TV land?
Yes.
Send us a question, comment, or suggestion to podcast@makingmoviesishard.com. If you like the show, you can leave us a review on iTunes. Check us out on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter at MMIH Podcast, YouTube at Making Movies Is Hard Podcast. Thanks to our amazing editor, Jeff Freimuth, for doing the editing. Thanks to Robert California Jones for doing our social media. And thanks to our producer, Eric Toms, for being awesome. Most importantly, thanks to all of you for listening, and talk to y'all next week.
Doesn't love a classic chocolate chip cookie? Famous Amos has been making them since the 70s, 1975 to be exact. With semi-sweet chocolate chips and a satisfying crunch, it's everything classic in one bite-sized cookie, and fans couldn't get enough. That's right. You'll find our original recipe, the one you know and love, in every bag of Famous Amos original chocolate chip cookies. Find Famous Amos anywhere you buy your favorite snacks.
You know when you're listening to a true crime story that has an unbelievable plot twist that makes you stop in your tracks? That's what our podcast, People Are the Worst, brings you with each episode. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Rebecca. We're identical twins who love true crime cases that make you say, "Didn't see that coming," and we hate the people responsible for them. Listen to People Are the Worst now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.